very good reason to
Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we review the Piccadilly Theatre Company's production of A Wilder Christmas. We discuss Tanya Pinkin's departure from Classic Stage Company's Mother Courage, Maren Mazey's return to performing, Wayne Rogers' passing, and Where Will We Eat with the closing of Angus Mankado. That plus more. Please stay tuned.
I got a crow. I got a brag. I think it's sweet. I have fingers and feet. I can wiggle and wag. I can climb trees and play tag with the breeze in the meadows below. I got a crow. If I were a very ordinary, everyday thing, I'd never be heard. Cock-a-doodling round like a bird, so naturally.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, January 3rd, 2015. Oh, 16. Are you still writing 15 on all your checks?
I've done very well so far.
All right. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Kritzerland, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good 2016 to you, Peter.
All of us. Let's hope for the best.
Absolutely. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears to Talk in Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
We also should mention that Talk in Broadway's got a little site design redesign.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed.
Looks great.
Yes.
I think so. I like it. A lot of people don't, I have to admit.
But, really? I haven't heard.
Yeah. But I think it's a terrific look, and I think the site's easy to navigate, too, so I liked it quite a bit.
Yeah, I didn't really understand the objections, but...
Did see them, though. You know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I have to go and look at that. You know, I do a lot of site work, site design work, and... I do a lot of commercial websites and things like that. And I have to tell you, the rule of thumb is a website redesign is not complete until everyone is unhappy.
Yeah, really. It does seem that way. But I will say there's one objection that I thought was most interesting, and that was from DOTD, who said, I'm colorblind, and these colors, I just can't tell after I click on something whether or not I've clicked on it.
That's interesting.
It used to be red and blue, and these two shades of blue, purple, violet, whatever, is something he just can't discern. So I don't know if anything will become of that, but I did think that was a pretty interesting observation.
Yeah.
Well, because I have that same problem, but I can see the difference in those two shades, but I can see why someone would not be able to.
Uh-huh.
Well, for all of you folks out there who would like to fix that, there is an extension for Chrome if you use the Chrome web browser that can that can help you out with that. And email me if you can't find it. I'll help you dig that up. All right. So moving into our reviews, we don't have many because of the holiday season, and we're just about to get into the winter of Broadway, where I guess we're going to start talking about lots of other things other than Broadway soon until the March rush starts. But Peter got a chance to see the Wilder Christmas. So Peter wanted to tell us about that.
Sure. Some years ago, about 20-odd years ago, 22, I think, actually, if we're going to be specific, there was a nice little company that didn't last very long called Willow Cabin Theater that did three Thornton Wilder one-act plays and in a program they called Wilder, Wilder, Wilder. Mm-hmm. And like everything else, today we get shows that are shorter, so they're doing two of the three plays now that were done that by Willow Cabin. So they're doing The Long Christmas Dinner, and they're doing Pullman Car Hiawatha. Now, this is at St. Clement's Church, thanks to the Peccadillo Theater Company, which is in residence there, an excellent group of performers, and these plays are very, very well done. They're also fascinating to any of us who have followed Thornton Wilder, and whenever anybody asks me, If you could have dinner with anybody in the world that has ever lived, I always say Thornton Wilder, because he strikes me as so interesting in the way that he's written so many different things. What's nice about these plays for the aficionado is that you do see little snatches that turned out to be the bigger plays, the plays we know as Our Town, The Matchmaker, and The Skin of Our Teeth. For example, there is a stage manager on the premises in this production, and there we are with Our Town. For The Matchmaker, there's only one reference, but it's kind of interesting to hear Ermengarde mentioned, which, of course, is a character in The Matchmaker and, of course, Hello, Dolly. The Skin of Our Teeth has a sequence where people represent the hours. They come on with Roman numeral numbers, and they do here, too, in these plays as well. So it's fun to see that. Now, aside from that, now, if you never knew Thornton Wilder at all, would you enjoy these plays? I hope so, because they make very pungent points. The first one, The Long Christmas Dinner, literally is a very long Christmas dinner because it takes place over decades. The point is that it's just people sitting around the table and talking, but life goes on. And I defy you to go there and not see your own relatives and friends at that table. You will relate to this greatly because, and what you do see is people who are just born coming out in little carriages with a nurse showing the baby off. By the end of the play, this is somebody who is very, very old and is having trouble eating because of perhaps a peritonitis or a Parkinson's disease or something like that. And this was a big Wilder theme, that time does pass, does it not? And that we have a tough time not realizing that time does pass, and we only realize it when it's too late. I have to say, whenever I give a speech at a graduation, I always point out to the kids, people say to you, oh, yeah, you have your whole lives ahead of you. No, you don't. Already 18 years are gone. I mean, you don't have your whole lives ahead of you. The only person who has his whole life ahead of him is the person who was just born a second ago, and now he even doesn't have his whole life ahead of him. And this is very Thornton Wilder-ish, because he really was concerned about time and how we don't appreciate and we let it go by. And that's really stressed very much here. So this is the more interesting of the two plays, I have to say. Pulmukar Hiawatha takes place in a sleeper car when people used to go by train. And it's going from New York to Chicago, presumably in 16 hours. And anything can happen in those 16 hours. Here's where the stage manager comes in. And there are 10 passengers on the train. And it's very slice of life. One of them is being taken to what was then called a lunatic asylum. And she's having a breakdown. And this is one of the more poignant parts of the show, that the nurse is so attentive to her and tries to calm her down and does her job so well. And when the person has calmed down, she just pulls, the nurse just walks over to the side, sits down and starts reading a magazine. I mean, she did her job. She's not emotionally involved. You got the impression she was from the way that she was handling the woman, but she's not. But she's not at all. We also have a death on the train. Somebody who you really didn't think was as sick as he or she, I'm going to be vague, said he or she was. And but again, you know, you just never know when death is going to strike. And again, you have to appreciate your life while you have it. And I have to admit, whenever a new year rolls around, I always think, well, the worst my tombstone is going to say is, and in this case, 2016. You know, think of how many people we heard died last week just before the new year. Patricia Elliott, Natalie Cole, Wayne Rogers, all, you know, really just their tombstones will say 2015, even though they almost made it into 2016. So all these points, these plays really get you thinking. And that's what's really quite wonderful about Thornton Wilder in the first place. He always makes you think. And what a unique imagination. Anybody who could write The Skin of Our Teeth, which to me is the one I like seeing more than any other, even though Our Town is my favorite play, tied with Three Sisters, it's Skin of Our Teeth that I always like to see because it is so bizarre. And I hope we get another revival soon. It's a tough one to do because there are so many people involved in it. But in while we're waiting for The Skin of Our Teeth, yeah, it's worthwhile going to see A Wilder Christmas.
Did you, you know, I have not seen The Long Christmas dinner in or read it in years, but it strikes me now that you're talking about it again, it sounds a little bit like, did you see that play The Big Meal?
Oh, exactly. Oh, there's no question The Big Meal takes its inspiration from The Long Christmas Dinner.
Yeah. You know,
because in The Big Meal, the thing is that people eat a big meal just before they die. That's when people eat that enormous – this. Action stops and somebody just simply sits there and eats. And that's what you watch for maybe a minute, maybe even more. I don't know. But but that's what they mean. They die here. They simply walk off into an area and that's the end of, you know. And but while it was very very good here in detailing the tragedies of the average life, you know, where people lose people prematurely, unexpectedly,
right.
And living old an old age doesn't mean, you know, that that's a good thing either sometimes, because if you have to live it under infirm circumstances, how much fun is that? Or is it? You know, I mean, these are the questions he loves to ask, and we provide the answers for ourselves. He allows us to do that, and that's what makes them pretty extraordinary works.
So that is at the theater at St. Clement's on 46th Street, and it's playing through January 10th. So you have about a week left to go see it.
They extended, which is nice. So they're doing business. So it's nice, because otherwise it would have closed today. I mean, with a title like A Wilder Christmas, you do expect it's going to be gone by the new year. But anyway, I'm happy that Christmas gets a reprieve.
That's great.
We've talked about a bunch of different people that perceive Christmas productions not being able to play all year round. And so it's good that this one at least extended 1 week.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the one that, of course, always comes to mind, and I'll admit it's 52 years ago, is Here's Love, the musical of Miracle on 34th Street, which opened in October and played till July, and probably would have played longer if it were a good show. It's a terrible musical, but it is a Miracle on 34th Street musical, and it was very interesting that the producer, Stuart Ostrow, who also produced 1776, said, I think there's a market for a Christmas show all year round because this is a beloved property. And, you know, I guess as time goes on, that perhaps has more credence than it used to, because I would imagine that in the middle of July sometimes, Christmas in July, okay, so let's say in the middle of May, somebody might pull out his DVD of A Christmas Story or A Miracle on 34th Street and say, I just feel like watching it. So I don't know. But there are seasonal things. Ironically enough, with my play Adam's Gifts, which is a riff on A Christmas Carol, many people have said, you know, it doesn't have to be done at Christmas because it has so little to do with Christmas, really. It has more to do with the characters who are in A Christmas Carol. So yeah, indeed, you know, it is a conundrum, you know, when you have these seasonal shows. Must we really be bound by the season to enjoy them? Aren't they enjoyable in their own right? Mm. So it's a good question.
Well, I think the really savvy shows are the ones that have Christmas scenes but don't revolve around it. So they get it both ways. Like, for example, Annie.
Annie, she loves
it. And arguably Mame.
Yeah, sure. Sure. Jerry Herman ever think when he wrote We Need a Little Christmas that it would become a standard at Christmas time? I mean, it's the right song for the moment. You can't say that he was just out to get a Christmas song. No, I mean, that the original play sets that up beautifully. I mean, it's not as if he did anything craven. It really was something that has really become a song that I hear when I go into stores various emporia during the Christmas season. I often hear We Need a Little Christmas, and I bet you do too. And what's also interesting to me, of course, at Christmas time is that's when you hear nice music in stores.
Exactly.
This is the
it one, all smells good.
It does. It's the one month of the year where you don't have to be assaulted by music that there's a store in Newark, I tell you. It's not only the station, that the radio station they play has such terrible music on it, but It's staticky. I don't know why nobody changed that channel. You have to hear terrible music with static. I mean, it's just so bizarre. So at least here in Manhattan, we got some very nice Christmas music in non-staticky fashion during the month of December, and I appreciate it.
On Christmas Day, I was at with my family, and they had on, I think it was PBS, or I'm not sure what station it was, but it was the Mormon Tabernacle Choir.
Oh, yeah.
And what they had put together a clip show of various Christmas concerts that they've done over the past decade or more, and they had some really great guests, one of whom was Angela Lansbury singing We Need a Little Christmas. I'm not sure how long ago it was. She was absolutely fantastic.
Isn't that something? Was there any selection from the Book of Mormon by the Mormon Tabernacle Choir?
No, I think it was older stuff. Oh, and another person that they had was Natalie Cole, and that was really just a few days before her death, so it was...
Oh.
Yeah.
So tell me about your experiences with Meet Me in St. Louis. I mean, that's got Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas in it. I don't know when it played on Broadway.
I guess it was the same season, I think, as...
but what point of the year did it play on Broadway?
Seemed like it was the summer.
I thought it opened in the fall and ran till the spring. That's what I recall. It wasn't anything worth seeing, I have to admit. I remember a complicated set, too, that seemed to be complicated just to be complicated. Yeah, so yeah, that's another one of those movies that should have been left alone.
You're right. November 2nd, 1980. Well, first preview October 19th, 1989.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Closed June.
I thought
closed June 10th, 1990. I didn't know it went that long.
Yeah,
June 10th. So they ran it just beyond the Tonys and didn't get anything.
Right. They did get nominations because it's but they were bone throw nominations. Nobody
Jason Workman got a Theater World Award.
And I don't know where he is. I haven't heard of him since. Really, that was actually a production where a lot of people disappear after doing it. That you don't hear much about anyway. I don't know, disappear. I mean, for all I know, they're big stars in Hollywood. But
he's in L.A. He's been in L.A. for some years.
Is he working? Is he doing well? He does well.
I'm looking right now. His IMDb is not recent stuff.
Okay,
but he was working a lot in L.A. in the 90s.
Good. Oh, good.
And as you remember, Donna Kane, did that production of Dames at Sea that was at the Lambs Theater.
Uh huh.
That was afterwards, if I recall. Mm-hmm. But you're right that a lot of those people haven't, for whatever reason, gone on to. Of course, Betty Garrett is no longer with us. Yeah. The thing I remember about that show was one of the funniest lines I've ever read was in Frank Rich's review for the Times, and he quoted, I guess he didn't react well to the sentimentality of the story. Let's put it that way. And he quoted the line in one of the new songs, "Ice is twice as nice."
Uh-huh.
And he said, they sing Ice is twice as nice and you want to respond, but liquor is quicker.
Oh, boy.
And we know who originally said that line, of course. Candy is dandy, but liquor is quicker is the original quotation from Dorothy Parker. Which used to show up in every joke book I used to get as a kid, and it was years before I understood what she was talking about. Years. Finally, I got it.
So Meet Me in St. Louis got 4 nominations: Best Musical, Best Book of a Musical, Best Original Score, Best Choreography in the 1990 Tony Awards. So
I was very lucky to get them. Very lucky indeed.
All right. So as I mentioned before, we don't have much to review this week, but we're going to talk about a bunch of things in the news. And one of the things that has come up is the Classic Stage Company's production of it has totally eluded me, Michael. What's the
Mother Courage?
Mother Courage with Tanya Pinkins in it. So, Michael, why don't you tell us about give the listeners a little bit of background of what's happening there?
Well, apparently it was going to be a new production that was going to use the original text, but in a highly edited version, and was going to present the play as filtered through the characters as they would appear if the play took place in the Congo. And so the issue seems to have been, how much was this new interpretation going to represent the black experience specifically? The original play by Brecht is about – I mean, it's set during the 30 Years' War, but the whole point of it is supposed to be the universality of the experience of war. It could be any war. It's just about how people react during a war, whether or not they retain their nobility. And so I think that that was the issue here, because according to her own statement and other reports, Tanya Pinkins wanted this version to more specifically reflect the black experience. And the question was how much it was going to do so, and she did not feel that it was going to do that to the point where she expected it to. So she quit.
Well, yes, but what's so flabbergasting is that she quit while she's still doing performances. She's still doing them as we speak. That's what's so amazing to me. I guess like it's a variation on giving 2 weeks notice when you quit a job. But it's very strange to me that she is still doing performances. And it's been very hard for me not to go down there and see what she's doing, because we still have the opportunity to do it. I know they don't want me there at this point, because I was supposed to go Saturday afternoon, all things being equal.
Oh, really?
But I was disinvited because we're going to see who the new person is. I would think by now we would have heard who the new person was. You know, time's a waste, and it's a big part. It's a wonderful play, by the way. I don't know if anybody has ever seen it, but my interpretation of the play is about this woman who is trying to make a living and makes a living during the war, but she certainly suffers during the war because everybody near and dear to her dies as a result of the war.
Right.
And the point is, do you care? How much do you care? What's more important to you, making a living or your family? Having your family with you or cleaning up? And she does clean up. She's a tough businesswoman. She gets what she wants, mm-hmm. but at a tremendous price. The fact that I heard there was no cart in this production. I read that right? No cart?
Oh, really?
Very strange to me because, I mean, Mother
Courage. It's iconic.
Exactly. Pulling that wagon is a very famous image. So,
as Tevye's cart.
Ironically enough, when Robert Burstein reviewed Fiddler on the Roof and didn't like it at all, this was one of the things he pointed out, that Jerome Robbins was stealing from Brecht and Father Courage, in essence. So it seems like a petty objection at this point in time, but still, the fact remains that the wagon is a very significant thing. I'm a little surprised to hear that it's not in there, and that does make me realize this must be some sort of maverick production, even aside from the fact that it's in the Congo. But it's so sad when something like this happens, you know, and becomes so public. And at first, you may recall the report said, Tanya Pinkett says, "I'm not saying anything. My lawyer tells me not to," and I think it was less than a day later that it all came tumbling down, that she came out with an enormous statement, and so did Buzz Kulik, who's directing, and so did Larry Kramer, who had his opinions, and so was Michael Spots, who's in the show. This is really something, you know, and we will see how much this affects classic stage, which is going through some tough times on a number of levels. And as Michael pointed out to me earlier, I had forgotten that Buzz Kulik is not going to be there much longer anyway, that he's going to be succeeded by John Doyle. So it's sad that one should have one of this that should have a production like this be one of the final efforts that an artistic director does at a company. You'd like to go out on a much happier note than this. And yes, there are some productions to go, and I don't know if Buzz Kulik is going to be directing them, but still, this is a black eye for everybody involved, you know, because you just wonder why Tanya Pinkins got this far without saying something. And again, I guess she has to be given some credit for staying with it for a little bit longer, considering that she's so displeased. But what is going on down there at the moment when she's doing this show? Is she walking through it? Is she doing her own interpretation? I don't care about anybody else. What's the audience reaction? I don't know anybody who's seen it, but it is very tempting to get down there.
I did not quite realize that she was still doing it. That's amazing. It must be packed.
Yeah.
I would think.
Don't you think?
Yeah.
I would. Maybe this is the hottest ticket in town now. Who knows? You know? All right. We can't get into Mother Courage. Let's go see Hamilton. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe that's what's going on. Who knows? But really, it must be quite an experience. But traditionally, when things like this happen, you say, oh, I can't wait to go. They usually turn out to be terrible. And I imagine a lot of people coming out of there saying, gee, that was really bad. I'm guessing, you know, yeah. But that traditionally, that's what happens. You know, like, for example, a few years ago when a company announced they were doing moose murders, I remember saying, yeah, sure, it sounds like fun right now, but try sitting in front of it, you know, and within 10 minutes, you're going to say, why am I here? And that's exactly what happens. So
same thing with what? Oh God, the title just went out of my head. The James Kirkwood play.
Oh, Legends. Mm. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Legends. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And at least for me, but not for others. Carrie. I didn't like the Carrie revival at all.
Absolutely.
At all. You know, so, but Carrie brought a lot of pleasure to a lot of people, and it's being done everywhere. Though I maintain it wouldn't have happened if indeed Cad Mandelbaum hadn't titled his book Not Since Carrie. Mm. I really believe that is why that is what has kept Carrie in the public eye. Truly, if that had been Not Since Nick and Nora, then that would be the show everybody would be trying to resuscitate. So really, those writers of Carrie should be indebted to Ken Mandelbaum, even though at the time, I'm sure, they were kind of furious to have their show as the poster child for the biggest for big flops, you know. But really, it's given Carrie such a second life. And the Rodgers and Hammerstein organization picked it up. And I'm telling you, they're making money from it. I guarantee you.
Well, especially with this new spate of, I guess, site-specific productions that people are doing in various places.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot
that seems to have been – that seems to have really – you know, so which just leads me to think it's more about the experience than the actual text and the songs.
I agree.
That's what, you know, but the last time they brought it back was the Lortel, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was quite boring.
Yeah.
So, and I thought the original was quite exciting. You know, crazy, off the rails, yes, but very exciting. And half of it was really magnificent. Magnificent. I'll stand by that. And half of it stunk.
Yes.
So, but it was far more arresting and galvanizing, and your eyes didn't want to leave the stage, while at the Lortel, I wanted to leave the building. So yeah.
I just wanted to say about the Tanya Pinkins situation at CSC is that I'm friends with Tanya on Facebook, and she and I have traded some emails over the years, but I can't really call myself a close friend of hers. And before this story broke, you know, her Facebook timeline and her Twitter, I don't know if she's got a Twitter account, but her Facebook timeline, just very positive stuff, you know, and not so much, I'm just saying positive in general, not positive about the CSC production, but she wasn't bitching and moaning about it. And she could have easily done that. She's got a lot of followers and a lot of friends on Facebook and done that. And she basically said her piece in her statement. And she's not out there trashing CSC and not trashing the theater community. She's getting a lot of support from her friends and family. Mm-hmm. And this has got to be a very difficult thing for anybody to go through, especially having to perform the role for another week while after this has come to light. So
everybody loses.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things. And really, when you think of it, it's amazing things like this don't happen more often. In terms of artistic differences, as the euphemism goes. But this is really the quintessential case of it.
Well, they don't happen so often that they're made this public of the
good
of
point
the, of the
very
discourse.
Good point. Yeah. If we were flies on walls in rehearsal rooms, we may see that there's a lot that's going on. Sure. Yeah, I'll concede that point in a second, Michael. You're right about that.
Yeah. So hopefully that this. There will be some sort of positive take after this. I've seen some other theater companies that have posted publicly that they want to do the Mar of the Courage that Tanya Pinkins wants to do. So maybe she'll be able to do a production that she feels best represents her views somewhere else, and we'll be able to tie this issue up in a nice positive outcome.
Well, in the meantime, I'm glad I got to see Meryl Streep do it at the Delacorte a few years ago. That was really quite something.
Mm.
There was a woman who did it at the fondly remembered John Cocteau Company, who was extraordinarily good, too, who was Lorinda – do you know who I mean?
Lizitza?
Yeah, she was terrific.
Brenda Lizitza, yes.
She was terrific in it as well. You know, so marvelous showpiece for an actress, no question about that. You know, so Olympia Dukakis, I remember, did it in Boston. And in one of the releases, Tanya Pinkins mentioned she had talked to Olympia Dukakis, who had done it 7 times.
Wow.
I hadn't realized that at all, you know, but I do recall her doing it in Boston and having a great success with it. I saw a production at Emerson College back in 1966 that I will never forget as long as I live. I could take you to that stage right now and point you where people were. It was so terrific. It was my first experience with the play, I'll grant you. I think, by the way, Henry Winkler was in that production, I think. I think I since heard that, you know, that Fonzie was in Mother Courage. Who knew? But anyway, but he was at the school at the time anyway, you know, so a tremendous, tremendous production. So this play really does have power. There's no question about that. And I really do hope that they get it together at CSC because, wow, you know, when it works, it really is something.
All right, we're going to move on to our next topic. I want to know from Michael and Peter, what did you do New Year's Eve? Did you do anything fun and special?
Yeah, Linda and I went to the Edison Ballroom and had a wonderful time. You know, drinking, dining, dancing. It was really quite a nice place. They had two different bands that spelled each other. One was a Latin band and one was a more conventional big band. So we had a wonderful evening and made it to 2016.
Good. Michael, anything special?
Well, I wound up going with some friends to a Thai restaurant on West 51st Street, just sort of opposite Wicked, and getting there was half the fun, let me tell you.
Yeah. I was going to bring that up too. Yeah. Yeah.
They literally had to send one of the employees down to the corner to pick us up. You know, it's just insane.
Well, which brings up a good point, though. I mean, I remember vividly when shows used to play on New Year's Eve, and the only Broadway show that played this New Year's Eve was indeed The King and I, because it wasn't anywhere near Times Square. Do you recall when New Year's Eve performances stopped for Broadway shows?
I don't think it was that long ago, but what interests me is that they all kind of globally decide, you know, or maybe the police department asked them, can you please change your schedule for that week?
Yeah, but I mean, it's so interesting to me that once upon a time, that was the big performance of the year. I mean, they used to charge more money for that performance than any other performance. Now, of course, the entire Christmas week, they charge for more for performances. But way back when, it wasn't
Peter,
it was simply New Year's Eve. What?
The most expensive seat on Broadway this year is the Olive Garden at $400 a seat.
Wasn't that something?
New Year's Eve.
We didn't remotely pay that, believe me. You know, but wow. But yeah, Linda and I spent a good deal of the time talking about next year what city we're going to go to get out of New York, to not be around here for New Year's Eve, because the poor soul getting home, she had such a tough time getting home. I didn't. I walked the 9 blocks to where I live, but she lives downtown, and I'm telling you, she had a tough time getting home because she expected to take the subway. No, you can't go through here. Go to 49th Street. 49th Street, no, you have to go to 54th Street.
I know. It was.
You had that same thing too, huh, Michael? Yeah.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yes, but anyway, so we got to the place is called Broadway Thai, and it was really nice. And once we got there, and it was fun because they had a piano player who it turns out that I worked with briefly at the theater circle shops. His name is Jordan, and he was really great, and he was playing, and the people I went with was the family of Giuseppe Bozzilio, who is a really great young performer who was one of the Billy Elliots on Broadway and in Chicago, and then he was in Newsies, and now he's in Aladdin.
Oh, how nice.
And so he, you know, he's a great singer, actor, dancer, and he was with his brother, Yannick Bitancourt, who is a dancer at the Paris Opera Ballet and was just here for the holidays. And so they got up and did some numbers together, and everybody just loved them. And I got up and sang Someone to Watch Over Me in a few shows.
Oh, that's great. Good
for
you.
That's great.
Yeah, it was.
Any video? Is it on YouTube?
Yeah, but I'm going to have to sign a release on it.
Surely you can work out some easy terms, Michael. You know, yeah. So.
I forgot that you worked at the Theater Circle Shops.
For almost 3 years. Yeah.
Did you know that I used to model for their catalogs?
Is that true?
Yeah. There's a picture floating around the internet of me naked in a Les Mis towel.
Well, excuse me while I go look that up.
Okay. I swear to you, there is.
See you next week.
Oh, my God. That's
so
great.
Linda had to go from Times Square to 49th Street up to 54th Street to get home on New Year's Eve. She could have stopped by 54 Below, Feinstein's 54 Below, where she could have seen Marin Mazzie.
And God love Marin for being able to do this. You know, she's had a tough time of it, as we all know.
Tell the listeners what's going on with Marin.
Well, she has had a cancer incident, as we like to say, under difficult circumstances. And she seems to be rebounding. And certainly the interview she's given and the pictures she's shown show her to indicate that she's going to beat this, that she is in the process of beating this. And that she certainly ain't down yet. And I admire her courage and her stick-to-itiveness. And I'm delighted that she was able to perform on New Year's Eve, even though I wasn't able to see her. So I hope some of our listeners will weigh in and say, yes, I was there, and tell us how she was. But I hope the reports are all, of course, that she was quite wonderful.
The New York Times just did a wonderful interview with her about all this, and that prompted me to repost. I had interviewed her when she did Zorba at Encores earlier this year, and it turns out, I mean, it really is amazing. I think it was immediately before her diagnosis, but she had already had the idea that something was wrong. And had gone in for tests and stuff, although she didn't tell me that at the time. But it's really quite amazing because Zorba is so much about life and death.
Yeah,
and especially her character of the leader.
Sure.
And so we talked about that, and to read the interview now in that context is quite something. So I reposted it, and I got more response than anything I have ever posted on Facebook.
Wow!
So I'll send it to you, James, if you want to put it.
Oh yeah, no, you. That's right. You did send it to me earlier in the week, and I zoned on that. Yeah. So I'll put that in the show notes as well. But I thought it was quite something. She's married to Jason Donnelly, and Jason and Marin had kept everything very quiet, and then a few months ago, I would think like October, November, made it public that she was going through this and posted she's been through chemo and lost her hair and things like that, and posted a lot of pictures that you wouldn't think that somebody who is in a performing arts business would post, and it was met with wide popularity for, you know, getting out there and tackling this illness head on.
And yeah, when you think how many performers don't want you to know how old they are,
yeah.
They're afraid of, you know, not getting roles as a result of their age. And I'm not criticizing them. I'm only saying that imagine how much more difficult it must be when you hear that somebody is not well and you know that you're dealing in the business of 8 a week and all that. You know, so it does take tremendous courage to be upfront about this. And our hats are off to Marin for doing it.
All right. Also in the news this week, Wayne Rogers, who is better known as Trapper John MD and played a doctor also on MASH, also had quite a history in Broadway. So, Michael, why don't you tell us about Wayne Rogers?
Yeah, if I knew this, I had completely forgotten, but he was a producer on 6 shows, all within the space of, let's see, October 1981 through June 1985, Einstein and the Polar Bear.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
Okay, Grown Ups, which it was a Jules Pfeiffer play, right?
Mm-hmm.
Duet for One, which had – now that had Anne Bancroft. Was that the one where she became ill?
Right, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then
Max von Sydow was the doctor to whom she went. She was a classical musician. That was the character, and of course she can't play anymore, and her whole life just disappears before her eyes because of this illness. So
multiple sclerosis, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah. Yes, and there's a quite little known film of it with Julie Andrews.
Yeah, yeah, I've never watched it, but I do have it. Yeah.
So those were Wayne Rogers' first 3 shows as producer. And then the next 3 and the last 3 were all Neil Simon shows. Little Me, The Revival, mm-hmm. Brighton Beach Memoirs in 83, and The Odd Couple, the female Odd Couple in 85.
Yeah, at least he had one smash hit, because Brighton Beach Memoirs is one of the longest running plays, non-musicals, of the last third of a century. So at least he had one hit, you know, there. The Odd Couple may have made back its investment because it ran even more than a year. No, not quite. But anyway, it might have made back its investment. I'm not optimistic it did, but it might have. Little Me was, though, a big disappointment. If some people think we're talking about the Martin Short Little Me, we are not. Oh. We are talking about one that James Coco and Victor Garber did together where they split the roles. Little Me is famous for having 7 roles played by the same man, but in this production they decide to split the roles to no good advantage as far as I was concerned. But
as I may have mentioned not long ago, I had interviewed Victor Garber and we talked about it, and I think he basically said that the reason that happened was that James Coco did not feel he was up to doing all of them because he was really quite old and I think already not well at that point.
I see.
Mm. So I'm not saying that's, you know,
yeah.
That's a good reason. I mean, but they, you know, that was the rationale.
Well, so anyway, one can look at this and say, well, obviously Wayne Rogers did 6 shows, and because one of the 6 was a hit and 5 therefore were not, which is, by the way, the usual standard average anyway. Mm-hmm. He obviously got discouraged and said, okay, I'm not going to do this anymore. And again, who knows the type of thing we were talking about earlier? Who knows how many Tanya Pinkins incidents he ran into here in these 6 productions that we haven't heard about, you know? So, I mean, here's Michael telling us about the possibility of James Coco not feeling up to it. And, you know, that's something I've never heard before. And this is not my way of saying I doubt it. It's just my point of saying, again, secrets are kept and things come out later. So Wayne Rogers may say, you know, life's hard enough, I'm going back to Hollywood.
I mean, you look at things like West Side Story and Company, you know, famous things that you've read about after the fact in rehearsal. And you know, maybe it's the fact that there was no internet back there, and you know, when those shows were that there was no Broadway World chat boards and all that chat Talk on Broadway and things like that. Yeah. I wonder, are we able to keep secrets anymore?
Well, more than one person has said to me over the years, gee, you know, I mean, given that both Dolly and Fiddler had terrible experiences out of town,
yeah.
They have been killed by the internet if the internet had been around then. And it's very
Yeah, maybe.
You know, boy, you know, I guess the first real victim of this was Seussical. And notice how Seussical has really rebounded. Not only done everywhere, and I'll grant you it's just a rhyme, but still that it's mentioned in Something Rotten in that famous musical number. I dare say that's the only Broadway failure that is mentioned in that big number in Seussical called a musical. All the other ones reference hits, you know, I know the tail wag the dog, yes, it's because it rhymes with musical, but still. They wouldn't have used it if indeed that show had just faded away totally, but it hasn't. The audience that comes to Something Rotten has heard of Seussical now, you know, but that was the first big victim of the internet, I think. The too much bad word of mouth was being spread around, so.
It's, I'm trying to think of. Do you really think that Seussical got killed because of the internet? I'm trying to think of other shows that might have been killed because of the internet.
Well, I do know there was a lot of activity about it, and I think it's a factor. I'm not saying the Seussical on Broadway was a work that I enjoyed to the nth degree, but it seemed to me that the poisonous word of mouth really traveled on that one. Yeah, that word of mouth thing is really a very hard thing. It really is. I mean, of course, it didn't take the internet to kill Merrily We Roll Along in 1981. The word of mouth on that, and it didn't before it even opened. And yet, we're talking about another show that's had a long life, hasn't it? Who would expect so many cast albums on Merrily and how many productions on Merrily? Because everybody wants to fix it. And I guess everybody wanted to fix Seussical, too, I guess.
Well, I also interject here that in the ensemble of Seussical was a young Casey Nicholaw.
Yeah.
Who is the director of Something Rotten.
Yeah, and yeah, it's always something to go back and look and see these people who are just dancers in ensembles who have really turned out to be legends in their own time. You
Which know? Is a perfect segue to something yes. I mentioned before we started. As some of our readers may know, they have recently released the two black and white telecasts of Peter Pan with Mary Martin from 1955 and 1956. I'm not 100% clear. I think either or both of them may originally have been in color also, but they only survive in black and white. But at any rate, and then it was done again. I think it was done several times, but then the last time it was done, it was 1960, and that was on videotape in color. And for a while, you could purchase that on DVD. I think maybe you still could find a copy of it. But this is a new release of both the 1955 and 1956 black and white versions. And I was watching the 55 one, and I just, you know, I waited to the end to look at the credits just to see, you know, who might turn up among the dancers. And guess who two of the dancers were? One is Suzanne Lucky.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I know who you're talking about.
Must be Susan.
Yeah, sure.
Who is Louise in the film of Carousel and Zanita in the film of The Music Man.
Uh-huh. And was invited by Birdie on Broadway. Go on.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And another dancer in the 1955 Peter Pan is Paul Taylor.
Oh, wow. So that's something.
Yep. Yeah.
I have a couple of observations. This spurs from me because hard to believe, but 20 years ago this month, Rent was in rehearsal. And, you know, that went fast. And little did we know that by the end of the month, everybody would have heard of Rent because, alas, Jonathan Larson, its author, died on the 25th of January. But anyway, Rent ran 5,123 performances at the Niederlander Theater, and which was a very famous house for having flops, and nobody wanted to go there. So I literally last night, because I'm writing an article about Rent, saying, let's see how many shows it took at the Niederlander Theater to amass 5,123 performances. And it turned out that the previous 68 productions at that theater over 42 years didn't even match the run of Rent. I mean, so, and Paul Taylor, by the way, Paul Taylor dances with two of those shows there. So that's what made me think of that. But the other thing, Michael, talking, it's so funny you bring up Peter Pan and Color. I was at a party the other day, and there was Jane Klein, who works for the Paley Center. And Jane is diligent as can be in working so hard to get things for that museum. She really is tireless in the zest of verb. Well, she had heard that when Peter Pan was broadcast in color on, if you had a color TV in 1955, not many people did, but that somebody had actually filmed it on an 8mm camera while it was running. So as a result, there was this essential color kinescope of this. And she called the guy who was like a godson. I don't know what he was, but I mean, it obviously wasn't the same person who had done the filming. But she worked so hard to find out who was there, how it happened, so on and so forth. And she called the guy and she said, I was on the phone for a half hour with him, begging him to look for this, so on and so forth, begging him, please, you must go in your closets, go here, go there. Is there anybody else you could ask? And he, and I believe this is the way the story went. The final line is accurate. But anyway, it was something like, well, let me look, and I'll get back to you. And he didn't, so she called him back a few days later. He had changed his phone number to an unlisted phone number.
Oh, God.
So I don't know if we're ever going to see that Peter Pan.
That's comment. Not very nice.
Oh, boy. So... so that Peter Pan, I've linked to it in the show notes on Amazon. There are two different versions that you can get to on Amazon. One is, I think, $18. Let me see what this is. It's $16. And the other one is $115.88. You can get the $16 one. So it's from... there was a release in 1999. That's the $115 one. I wonder what it's got different packaging, but I'd imagine it's the same similar thing.
We're talking about the 1960 color version.
Yeah. So okay, so I've linked to the cheaper one. So check that
good
out.
Good of you.
Peter, coming up this Tuesday night, what are you going to be doing?
Yes, indeed. My buddy Aubrey Berg, who is the chair of the Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, is coming to town. And I said, I'm taking you to dinner. Where do you want to go? He said, Angus. So I made a reservation for Tuesday, the 5th at 5 o'clock. And they haven't called me to say, look, we're closing today on Sunday. And that's going to be the end of it. This is pretty amazing when you think of it, because this was really the hot spot for so many years. It's been there 14, 15 years. And it really trumped Joe Allen's Ace for a while there. But what's so interesting to me is Joe Allen goes on, and here's Angus that turned out not to. I understand that the person who owns that building and a few buildings around there is thinking of doing something very dramatically different with that corner of 44th Street and 8th Avenue.
Well, speaking of, again, as I mentioned, I worked at Theater Circle for 3 years.
Yeah.
And that was already more than 5 years ago. And already then there was talk of that whole
plot,
that whole corner coming down.
Is that right?
Or, coming down or... I guess it would come down, and they would build another tower. But so that's not news to me in that sense.
Well, do we understand why Joe Allen's has been around forever? I mean, does Joe Allen himself
own the building?
Does he?
I do not know that, but I think that's a very good possibility.
Yeah,
I do too.
It's been designated historical, because once you're designated historical, you're stuck. There's nothing you can do.
And I do know.
But still, one would think that where rents go up here, there, and everywhere, and obscenely so, that Restaurant Row is a hot spot. So why isn't it happening there? I don't want it to happen there. Don't misunderstand me. But, yeah, of course, there is that building on the corner that's been in construction since 1904 that hasn't been finished. They obviously ran out of money and had some tough times there. But I remember the first time I was in Joe Allen's was the night after Promises opening, and I'm not talking about the revival. Mm. Really, in 1968 was my first visit to Joe Allen's. So, you know, I mean, it's pretty impressive that that place still goes on. And even though Angus did steal a lot of its thunder some years back. So I found this very hard to believe when I first heard about it. But it's definitely true.
I do know that Sardi's owns their building. That's
been
about. So they're, I think, safe as long as they want to continue. Mm. But I had the same reaction as you did, Peter, because Angus was so popular for really quite some time. But I guess, it must presumably just come down to landlord greed.
This is a
theater podcast, not a business podcast, but certainly if you are going into business, you want to own your real estate, because probably the most valuable thing in most businesses is their real estate. I mean, McDonald's, 7-Eleven, Sears, Kmart, they're all that valuable because of the real estate they own, not because of what they do on a day-to-day basis. Mm. You know, and the Catholic Church, who's I think the number one landowner on the island of Manhattan is the Catholic Church.
Isn't that something?
I'm pretty sure that that's true.
And number two is probably NYU.
Yeah. Mm. That's a whole other podcast.
Oh.
Get Leonard Jacobs in here to talk about NYU and land ownership, you know.
No, Spotlight is a movie that a lot of people think is going to win the Oscar, and I've been curious as to the Catholic Church's feelings about this in terms of ratings. And here's what I mean. I don't know if they still do this, but when I was a kid in Boston, we had a newspaper called The Pilot, which was the Roman Catholic newspaper that used to come out once a week. And they used to have a list of movies you could and could not see.
Really?
And it used to be morally unobjectionable, like the Disney movies you could go see. Morally objectionable in part, meaning you really shouldn't go. And then there was condemned. And condemned. And like, for example, Irma LaDuce was condemned. Yeah,
but didn't that... Wait.
Also condemned were the producers, The Odd Couple. Condemned. Now, if those movies are condemned, I imagine for different reasons, Spotlight is condemned. Because after all, I can't imagine the Catholic Church wanting people to see this picture. Yeah.
Didn't those come from a larger thing? Wasn't it called the Catholic Board of Review or something like that?
Something like that. Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah. But I remember my mother, you know, looking over that list every week to make sure I wasn't going to go see anything even morally objectionable in part. Like she could stop me, but that's another story, you know. So, so I just wonder if those still exist, if it still happens, and where Spotlight falls. Because, I mean, it's not as if Spotlight is showing you anything flesh-wise or anything like that.
Right.
But it's the message, of course, you know. So,
I was thinking it would be, you know, I guess it would be too much to hope for that, but it's possible that the movie might actually lead to some people being held accountable who were not so far. And that sometimes happens with works of art.
Sure.
The most famous example I can think of is The Jungle by Upton Sinclair.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
That was very famous in leading to forms in although it wasn't the intention that he had, but I just saw The Big Short, which was about the housing bubble and the subprime mortgages, which parenthetically I'll mention has several theater people in it: Finn Wittrock, Billy Magnuson, Tracy Letts is in a small but very pivotal role, and even Marissa Tomei shows up. So it would be, have either of you seen The Big Short?
No,
I haven't, but everybody's talking about it.
It's incredible. And, it ends with saying how only basically one person went to prison for just like really reprehensible actions. So who knows, maybe there'll be a big roundup, but I don't know if that's gonna happen. We'll see.
I mean, Spotlight had a bunch of Broadway connections, as did The Big Short, and we have to get Matt Tamanini back on to get us caught up on those things. Michael, did you have any list of the connections of the folks who were on? I think wasn't Brian D'Arcy James in Spotlight?
John Slattery has done Broadway. Slattery,
yeah. Yeah.
Of course, Liev Schreiber.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Stanley Tucci.
There were a lot of actors in that who've done theater. It's really quite something.
And Michael Keaton, who was in that movie, which was about theater.
That's right. Yeah, good point.
Tied back to the St. James, where Angus is, and it's all right, one small world.
Yeah, sure is.
All right. So before we wrap up, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device. Get a stream to you. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So, to change it up today, Michael's got a trivia question, but we'll get Peter to give us last week's answer first. So, Peter, tell us last week's answer.
Okay, well, the question was, he appeared in a very famous number in a very famous musical in the 50s. The number had two words in it that would appear in a possibly equally famous musical that he conceived in the 70s. Who's the person, the 50s song, the 50s musical, the two-word phrase, the 70s musical? I'm talking about Martin Charnin, who appeared in West Side Story, who appeared in G. Officer Krupke, which has the lyric, Leapin' Lizards.
Ah.
Which indeed turned out to be a significant line in the musical Annie, which he conceived in the 70s. So I'm not going to necessarily say that Annie is as famous as West Side Story, and I'm not sure it's not, but I did say possibly equally famous musicals. So anyway, that's the answer to that question. So Michael, you got one for us, huh?
Yeah, this is something I came across by accident. There was an actor or actress who won Tony Awards in the leading category for three consecutive Broadway shows that this actor or actress did. And they weren't quite in three consecutive seasons, but almost. So name the actor or the actress and the three shows. And it's probably not the first person who would pop into your head.
Mm-hmm. All right. So if you have an answer to that, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com, and we will let you know if you're on the right track. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway.
Lovely.
Bye-bye.
Thoughts, bye. Michael. Christmas? Like an owl, like a bat on the prowl, it's so satisfying. I'm whizzing,
whizzing,
through a cloud, past a star, I'm so proud, look how far I've risen. High over the moon, higher I fly. Bye, oh Mr. Moon, bid me goodbye. Heading far.